You wouldn't buy a car without a seatbelt, a laptop without Wi-Fi, or go a day without your cell phone. Could a business survive without the internet? Then why are many healthcare providers and provider organizations still not connected and enabled to share critical clinical information digitally in the care of your friends and family? Welcome to Notify, a podcast from Notu. Join host Dr. Peter Schock, Chief Health Officer, and Teresa Bell, Founder, President, and CTO, as they bring the profound impact of healthcare communication to life through frank conversation in understandable language and through real-world context. They'll demystify interoperability, helping you unlock the potential of healthcare communication at scale. You'll also learn the transformative impact of being Notu connected.
Connect.
Connect.
Listen.
Listen.
Transform.
Transform.
Well, welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Notify. Today, I'm very pleased. Two announcements, really. Number one is my co-host, who's normally with me, Teresa, is out today, so she will not be joining us. But in her place, we have a wonderful guest from a company called Equip Health named Kara Bohan. And Kara, I would love just for a moment for you to introduce yourself to the audience, a little bit about your history and so forth, and then we'll kind of go from there.
Yeah, thanks for having me. So I'm Kara Bohan. I am a clinical psychologist by training and a long time of practice. And now these days I am the Senior Vice President of Clinical Programs at Equip Health. And basically what that means is that I am really overseeing clinical care, the programming that we develop and provide for our patients, do a little clinical research and all things clinical for our company.
Wonderful. I'm a licensed clinical psychologist, and Equip Health has a very important niche, if you will, in the healthcare space. I want you to tell us a little bit more about Equip Health and your passion for it, what you guys are doing. And we'll get into it in detail in the next segment, but just give them a kind of a teaser about Equip Health, if you would.
Yeah. So Equip is a healthcare company that is providing virtual treatment for eating disorders. Eating disorders are an illness where they are treatable. It is a brain-based disorder that has a treatment. People recover, and yet it takes specialized care. And so access to treatment has been so challenging for people to find specialists. And so what Equip does is provide evidence-based treatment virtually so that people can recover at home anywhere that they need it.
Oh, that's fantastic. And I really look forward to getting into that. It's something as a primary care physician for 20 plus years that never felt really connected and didn't know how to serve some of my patients in the best manner because those services weren't readily available. And it can be intensive and multidisciplinary. So look forward to getting into that. So the layout today, basically, we're just going to talk a little bit about Equip Health. I want people to know what you guys do. I really want to bring some awareness to eating disorders and the potential treatments available. And I think you guys are different in that way and potentially provide an opportunity for people to receive care they might not get otherwise or in person because of the multidisciplinary nature and the specialization associated with it. Then talk a little bit about how you guys came to Notu to understand interoperability and what interoperability might be able to do for you, and maybe just a little bit about what we're doing together in that regard. And we'll get into that just as soon as we come back.
Yeah, sounds great.
Over 30 million Americans will face an eating disorder in their lifetimes. Yet only a fraction of them will receive treatment that works due to access barriers like high costs, a shortage of trained providers, and limited access to outcomes-based treatment. Introducing Equip, the leading virtual outpatient eating disorder treatment program for all ages in the U.S. With its evidence-based model, Equip seamlessly integrates into patients' lives, eliminating barriers to access and preserving essential aspects of their daily routines. Plus, in-network coverage from most major insurance companies makes accessing care with Equip easier than ever. Learn more at www.equip.health.
Connect. Listen. Transform. This is Notify with your host, Dr. Peter Schock and Teresa Bell.
Well, we're back, guys, with Kara Bohan today, talking about Equip Health, what they do in the marketplace, and their role in treating eating disorders, which is a very complex, and you know better than I do, as a primary care physician, it was very difficult, I think, to find the appropriate treatment and arrange appropriate treatment for people because it is so multidisciplinary and a comprehensive approach is necessary. So I'm really interested in how did Equip Health start? How did it get its start? How did it find its niche? And how did you get associated with Equip Health?
Yeah. So Equip was founded in 2019, and it came to be because our co-founders, Christina Safran and Aaron Parks, really were observing all of the challenges that people were experiencing getting treatment for eating disorders. And so Christina Safran is someone who suffered from an eating disorder herself as a child and an adolescent, was able to access treatment, but over the course of her experience, really was able to see people whose insurance cut out, who weren't able to afford care, who, you know, maybe they had to care for a little bit, but then, you know, the costs were such that they couldn't continue all the way through to recovery. She was always really frustrated by this and felt like it wasn't fair. She was able to achieve recovery, and yet so many people weren't. And that led her to initially found a nonprofit organization called Project Heal, which provided treatment grants to people to be able to afford care. A lot of eating disorder treatment meant going away to a treatment center, going to a residential center. You know, people weren't didn't have access to specialists where they lived, and so they had to travel somewhere. And so Project Heal was this nonprofit organization that Christina founded, which was to, you know, really aiming to give people access financially. When she met Aaron Parks is also a psychologist, was working at UC San Diego in the eating disorder clinic there, which is a world-renowned eating disorder treatment center, and was really experiencing, gosh, everyone was coming to San Diego, flying into San Diego from all around the world, really, to access treatment because they didn't have access at home. And when Aaron and Christina met, they really connected on this observation of, gosh, there's people who don't have financial access, people who don't have geographic access, and this is really a problem that needs to be solved. And I think another layer of that is also the idea that people were uprooting their lives to go to residential treatment when they could recover at home. There are treatments, there are outpatient treatments that work for eating disorders, but very few people know how to deliver them. And so people just didn't have access to those treatments that work. And so knowing this, in 2019, they teamed up together and founded Equip to really think about how we could partner with insurance companies, ensure that we have insurance coverage that will really cover the whole length of treatment that is necessary for recovery. Again, checking that box for financial access, but deliver it virtually so that we don't have this geographic problem, so that people in rural communities can still access evidence-based treatment that works for eating disorders, so that honestly, people in big cities where there's a heavy commute even can still access.
Right.
Can still access evidence-based treatment that works. So in 2019, they came together and really created this amazing company to provide this care.
That's an interesting history. There's so many key points there that number one is somebody personally affected by an eating disorder says, hey, we can do better. And as she comes into her own, begins to found a company to help others so that they don't suffer the same challenges that she had potentially and others in her era had in terms of the treatment. The other thing I think is interesting is just hearing that some people can't afford treatment, whether it's because they have to travel or because the treatments often are at the periphery of coverage for healthcare coverage. And so health equities play a significant role in people's ability to complete treatment and get better from eating disorders. And the virtual nature of it, removing some of those geographic and financial barriers, certainly help to scale the treatment, number one, treatment options, and number two, kind of break down those barriers, a little bit of health equity in that regard. Those were two things in your that just really stuck out to me that's really important. And then I think the other thing is just around the scale piece too, is I had a colleague who had a daughter who was in residential treatment in San Diego within the last couple of years. Now, she happened to be out there going to college and had the eating disorder before she went out there, so it was a natural place for her to be. It wasn't quite as disruptive in that regard. But it is, yeah, it's really, really interesting. How do you scale those specialized services when they're location based? And that's incredibly an incredible challenge. And it sounds like you guys are working through that with the virtual treatments. So you look like you were going to say something else. I didn't want to feel free to have a dialogue with me about it. I just want to touch on those areas.
Yeah, I was actually just thinking when you mentioned health equity and the virtual piece really gets me in that regard as well. One of the evidence-based treatments for eating disorders is family-based treatment. It works because recovery from an eating disorder is so challenging to really essentially fight your brain every time you're eating. And so family-based treatment takes the healthy people in your life and uses them to support you and help you get through it. And yet what happens so many times is that you have family-based treatment where the whole family is intended to come to the sessions. And yet because of someone needs to work, someone needs to be, you know, no one can't take off work. Yeah. And so often you would see only one parent coming. And then it leaves the other parent in the dark. They don't really understand what's going on. They don't really understand the illness, the treatment protocols and approaches, and because they're left out of treatment. What happens virtually is that we have people able to join from their phones on their lunch break at work and can join in where otherwise they wouldn't have been able to come to the session. They wouldn't have been able to understand the treatment and how to support their loved one through recovery. Virtual treatment eliminates that barrier.
Yeah, boy, I love that. I also wonder, just in thinking about it, and my mind begins to draw parallels to other types of health problems that require kind of spontaneous and immediate intervention to be most helpful. When I think about addiction types of services, or even severe mental health around depression and suicide, those kind of things, there are services that, when well placed, need to be easily accessed and immediate in response. And it's hard to do that if everything is in person and you have to travel to do those things. So I would imagine that helps in some of those areas as well. Really, the family piece of it was interesting to me. And again, I'm going to claim some ignorance. You're educating me today as much as you are our audience about some of this, because while I was an internist for 20 years and remain a licensed clinician, not practicing anymore, I would say that these were on the periphery. We would identify potentially an eating disorder and then consult out for services. And then if the eating disorder was confirmed, they were kind of lost for some period of time because they were in treatment with multiple specialists, and we didn't get necessarily as much line of sight into that. And they didn't need to see us if they were getting the care that they needed from someone else. So it's not one of those things that I know a lot about, except that it's underserved. It probably is underrecognized. I love bringing some awareness to it as well.
I think to that point, you know, what we have learned, we have at Equip, we have a multidisciplinary treatment team. You kind of mentioned that earlier, that it hits so many different disciplines that need to work together to support the recovery, you know. And so we have therapists, we have dietitians, we have medical providers, and all of them have gone to school for their, you know, for their work. They're licensed professionals in their field. And yet most of the training programs that they graduate from don't teach eating disorders.
Oh, very true. Yeah, I can attest to that.
And so it makes sense that people come out of their education, you know, and get licensed, you know, become licensed professionals and still have never treated an eating disorder or never, you know, been trained to understand eating disorders. So you're not alone.
Well, it's interesting because I think, you know, a big area of mine over the last 13 years has been population health, the leading population health for a number of different health systems. And people don't realize that 70% of what determines whether we're sick or healthy has nothing to do with the presence or absence of clinical disease. It has to do with where you live, what language you speak and what language your doctor speaks. Can you afford treatment? All those kinds of things, what we call social determinants of health and comorbid behavioral health issues or healthy behaviors, meaning attitudes toward food, exercise, all that kind of stuff that we accrue like barnacles over a lifetime. We never know where they come from until they have a detrimental effect on our overall health. And then we seek medical care. Only 10% of what makes you sick or healthy is related to the presence or absence of clinical disease. Yet that's where my 28 years of schooling was focused. And that's where the health system has largely focused all its assets and all its efforts is treating the presence of disease as opposed to the other pieces. So I love this. And this feels something similar. It's just a disease we haven't recognized. So a couple of things that come to mind as I think about this. We talked a little bit about scaling the specialists and the multidisciplinary team by doing it virtually. But that also means that there is an, I wouldn't say it's an increased burden, but there, just because of the nature of the multidisciplinary team, there is an increased burden for accurate communication, especially in a disorder where every person on the team has critical insight and critical input to the overall treatment program. How do you guys accomplish that virtually, presently? I'd love to just understand that a little bit.
It was very fundamental to the founding of EQIP to have that interdisciplinary team be internal, be in-house, because that communication is so fragmented when folks are putting their own treatment teams together out in the wild, so to speak. That you've got to figure out how do you get on the same page, especially because there are different there's different approaches to treatment. And I've experienced patients getting mixed messages, where a dietitian is thinking this approach might work. The therapist is thinking this approach might work. They're not on the same page. The patient's getting mixed messaging. So a couple of things that I think really help with that team communication at EQIP is, first and foremost, we have a robust clinical training that all of our providers go through when they start working with us. What it does is it helps, especially for folks who didn't get eating disorder training in their education, it helps give them that foundation. But even people who have experience with treating eating disorders, what our training does is really align everyone on a singular kind of approach so that we're all working from the same foundation in terms of the treatment approach. That's a good base, so that at least you know that everyone on the team is working from the same model, so to speak. And so then on top of that, we have an internal electronic medical record that we have we have a great product and tech team that has built our own electronic medical record. The great part about that is that it allows us to have that virtual access to our patients' sessions. Patients can message the team, but we also have then team communication within that electronic medical record as well. And so the team can communicate with each other about patient care. Patients can communicate with the team either individually if it's just something that, requires, it's just a quick conversation between a singular provider, but they can also message the entire team as a whole if it's something that they really want the whole team to be aware of. And again, not have that fragmentation of now I have to tell you, and now I have to tell you, and now I have to tell you, like, get everyone on the same page.
And Karen, they all have access to the same clinical information in that record?
And then absolutely, because every member of our team is based at EQIP, then we all, everyone is living in the same electronic medical record.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So team communication you guys solve for within your training and platform and just the culture of how you do work. How about connecting to the rest of the healthcare ecosystem? I would imagine that some of these people that come for eating disorder treatment have other conditions as well. Maybe if they're young, they don't, but they probably have a pediatrician or a family practitioner or an internist as part of their care. How do you guys plug back into, and they may unfortunately need hospitalization, that kind of thing. How do you plug into the rest of the healthcare ecosystem?
Absolutely. And this is an area where we're constantly growing and continuing to evolve what our opportunities are there. I would say, especially early on in EQIP's lifetime, we had a lot of faxes, a lot of, you know, registering fax, a lot of medical assistance on the phone, trying to...
Unfortunately, Kara, people can't see the face you made in the body language when you said fax. It was almost like a confession. But, you know, fax is still, despite what we're doing, fax is still one of the dominant forms of communication in healthcare. About 70% of information is communicated via fax.
Healthcare is going to keep the fax alive.
1960s technology. I don't have any other 1960s technology in my home. Fax is
the... You know, and what's interesting is that I honestly think most, maybe I don't have the actual data on this, but most places I have worked, the faxes come in digitally anyway. And so it ends up being converted by some system on the back end eventually.
Electronic fax. I had four fax machines. Now, this was back in 2007 or 2017. I had four fax machines whirring constantly in my office every day. That little drone of white noise was the fax machine. It never stopped. And we paid people to pull faxes off, sort through them, put them in folders that we could sign off, and then scan them into the record. And now we have since moved, obviously, to e-fax, or the electronic fax version that you're talking about, which makes it a little easier to manage, but it's still a huge part of healthcare. And because it's honestly, it's trusted. We know exactly how to manage it. We're familiar with the workflows, and it's easy. I think until interoperability gets as easy as fax everywhere and people understand it that way, we'll still have the challenge. Anyway, didn't mean to take you off topic, but it's interesting that you mentioned that.
No, absolutely. And so that's where we are. And I think we're getting better. And I know we're going to get there eventually in this conversation, if not now, but, you know, we're getting better with being able to communicate with other electronic medical record systems, with help from you all. But, I definitely think that is, and will continue to be, an ongoing challenge as different electronic medical records, you know, being able to talk to each other. And so instead we're stuck with the ancient fax, essentially.
Yeah. And then you have to manually put any information in that's meaningful to you guys discreetly in your record that you might need for whatever purpose. It's interesting. I'm going to ask you a question. I hope it's not an insensitive question. Like, it may just be my fumbling for words with it, but if I think about it, does healthcare ask you to connect to them, or are you more interested in, are you driving the connectivity to the rest of the healthcare ecosystem because it's valuable for you to have the clinical information contained in those records for the work you guys are doing?
I think it's both, and okay. It definitely depends on the patient and their outside providers. So what I mean by that is that there are some, we get referrals from some PCPs who are like, I don't understand eating disorders. I don't get eating disorders. I don't know. So I really would like to hand this off and, like, you know, just be done with it. I don't know what to do with this challenge. And yep. So feeling so overwhelmed that, like, I don't need updates because this is a handoff. This is not a, shared mutual patient anymore. And so in those cases, you know, we're like, well, but it could be beneficial to still, you know, check in, especially, you know, we do have medical providers, but all of our medical providers are still providing telehealth. It's still virtual. It's still virtually yep. delivered. And so there are times when in-person vital sign collection
or something
so valuable. In that case, we do want, we're like, well, don't let go completely, because we might want them to come to you for some in-person vitals. And then we do need that information back, right? We need those vital signs reported back to us in some way. We will order our own labs through Quest and LabCorp and, you know, and some of those main lab companies. Patients will go out, and then, you know, we do have mechanisms then obviously to get the labs from those lab companies. But these are all ways in which absolutely we need data from other sources, other places, whether they're getting vital signs, whether they're having ongoing care. And in that case, we're working in the cases of the handoff, we're working to try to get information from people who aren't that eager to share. Not that they're trying to hide anything, but just the partnership is more on us. Is more of us than them. On the flip side, we absolutely have PCPs who we work with who are absolutely engaged in patient care, want to be involved and want to know how to best support their patient. And then they come to us wanting information from us. So I guess my answer is it goes both ways. And it's a case by case basis where sometimes it's us pushing, saying we need information from you. And sometimes it's the outside provider saying, you know, gosh, I really want to know what's going on because I want to best support my patient.
And not to put you on the spot, but what information do you guys feel like is most important from a clinical record of a PCP or a pediatrician or from a hospital visit for the patients that come for eating disorder treatment?
First and foremost, number one, top of the list is growth history. So height and weight data, historic. One of the common treatment goals for eating disorders has to do with weight restoration that is often lost in the course of the disordered eating, and really working hard to set target weights and understand what amount of weight needs to be restored. It's such an individualized basis. Body sizes are different. There's no one size fits all body size. It's not, you know, a lot of people used to do this 50th percentile for kids and adolescents, and they'd shoot for a, you know, standardized BMI for adults as if like everyone was some standard body size. Yeah, yeah. And so what we do is really shoot to individualize those targets. And we use growth history to say, okay, before you had an eating disorder, where was your body falling in the norms? Let's get you back there because that seems to be the right place for your body. And if we don't have that historic data, it's so challenging to set those goals and you know, determine what amount of weight we need to restore.
It seems to me in the conversation that we're thinking, that we're talking about, my experience with eating disorders has either been suspected eating disorder and refer out as I suspect it. But even then it feels like it's relatively far along the process, right? Because I would imagine that the sensitivity that I had as an internist, where I would take care of adolescents to the end of life, was probably different than a pediatrician who was looking at growth charts every day, those kinds of things.
Yes.
But then the other experience I had was catching people in the hospital when it's a catastrophic result of a prolonged eating disorder, or part of that catastrophic result in the journey, and then getting them back. You guys are really trying to move things as far forward as you can in the treatment by making these things available, which makes a ton of sense to me as well. Dr. Chuck epiphany as I heard as you were talking.
But you're spot on. I mean, you're spot on. The data are very clear that early intervention is most effective and can stop an entrenched, prolonged course of an illness. And so if we could see everyone, most eating disorders start in adolescence. If we could just get it right away when folks are adolescents, especially because when they're adolescents, they live in the home with hopefully helpful, healthy, supportive parents who can help them through it. You know, let's do it then, because it's so much harder when they're 10 years in, living alone and suffering oftentimes in silence.
And Kara, I don't want to put you on the spot, but you just reminded me that I've been remiss. I don't want to pretend I know things I don't know, and I don't want to pretend our audience knows things we don't know. And I think there are some probably level-setting facts that might be helpful as we look at the importance of what you guys are doing and then the importance of being connected, which we'll get to here in just a few minutes. But we've kind of touched on the surface of that, and then we'll kind of get to it in earnest in terms of what you're doing, though, too. But as I think about it, what are the statistics for the incidence prevalence of eating disorders of either, you know, any type? And then what are the earliest screening things or things that people should be looking for? I feel like it's hard to talk about a topic like this without addressing incidence and prevalence, and how do you look for it, to be frank. And then I'd love to have you segue into how you guys are helping train people on the front lines or educate people on the front lines to screen for those things.
Yeah, absolutely. So approximately 29 million Americans will suffer from an eating disorder over the course of their lifetime. Wow. It is a billions of dollars cost to society as a whole on an annual basis. And when we think about the course of the illness, so many eating disorder cases begin in adolescence. If they are treated in adolescence, people recover absolutely and go on to live very healthy lives. And for a percentage of folks who don't get treatment early, they can end up on this really chronic course of illness that can, lead to just lifetime of suffering and challenges. What ends up happening is so many times things get overlooked as maybe in early childhood or adolescence. Oh, it's a phase, they'll outgrow it, or oh, that's kind of normal. Our culture has this pervasive feeling of, we refer to it as diet culture, this idea that, weight loss is good, smaller bodies are good. And so a lot of times the very same behaviors that we're describing as an illness are things that are praised and actually kind of promoted in our society, eat less fat, only eat vegetables. These things are viewed as great things to do for your health and for your body. And yet they're the same things that we see actually lead people to hospitalization. I think there are, you mentioned screening. I think that there's the obvious screening of going to the doctor's office, seeing an abrupt shift in weight trajectory. So for, growing children, adolescents, it's falling off the curve. So maybe it's not even a weight loss, but it's a lack of weight gain when it should be expected of children, adolescents. With adults, it would be a dramatic weight loss. For people in smaller bodies, that ends up getting caught pretty easily. For folks in larger bodies, it's a lot harder to catch that because people think, oh, that's a great thing. You lost weight.
You're getting healthy. And yeah.
Right. And yet it really truly has to do with, well, why did the weight go down? What was going on? And is the reason for that weight loss, was it a healthy weight loss? Was that something that, makes sense? We talk about this, the bias of like, oh gosh, you look great. Did you lose weight? Is like meant to be like a compliment. And yet, forget about eating disorders. Some people lose weight because they're ill, they have cancer. Some people lose weight because they have, it's not always a positive thing. And so I do think as a society, we really need to shift that mentality to erase some of this bias, because the bias is leading to missed diagnoses of eating disorders, where weight loss is not viewed as something to be concerned or worried about.
Yeah, interesting. Very interesting. Yeah. Well, I appreciate that very much. And I would imagine that many times for children and adolescents, it may be a loved one that recognizes things first and brings it to the attention, yes, of the provider than just the provider.
I would also add, I was focusing on weight loss there. Not all eating disorders are characterized by weight loss. We have, bulimia nervosa, which is characterized by binge eating and some kind of a compensatory behavior, perhaps self-induced vomiting, perhaps excessive exercise, or binge eating disorder, which is an eating disorder characterized by recurrent binge eating in the absence of any compensatory behavior. You're not necessarily going to see the weight loss, obviously, in those instances, in which case it really does require asking the question about self-induced vomiting, asking about excessive exercise, and asking those questions that you might feel uncomfortable about the answer to. And that I think is a big barrier for a lot of doctors and a lot of, you mentioned, family members too. I think there's a little bit of like, don't ask, don't tell. I don't really want to know the answer, because then I don't know what I would do with it
There's, I think that's true. I think that's true in the provider community too. I remember the only thing I can liken it to was when we initiated across all of our primary care practices for the purposes of our ACO and value-based arrangements, the in-office screening for PHQ-2. And we built it into the workflow. Mm-hmm. We built it into the office, or to the EHR. And the pushback we got there wasn't because doctors didn't know what depression was or didn't have the tools to potentially treat depression from a pharmacologic perspective or referral for counseling, et cetera. It was because it changed the nature of the visit. And I honestly, it was one of the most disillusioning things I ever heard, but said, well, I was good. They were coming in for sinusitis, and now because the PHQ-2 was positive and they have depression, it changes the whole nature of the visit. Now I've got to talk about depression. I wasn't prepared for that when I walked in the room, and it's now a 30-minute visit or an hour visit. And the tough thing is, I do understand all that, but what are we doing if we're not doing those things? It's the same thing with social determinants of health and questions about health equity. I can't assume those things, and the information doesn't just fall out of the sky. It comes by an attentive person in a room, seeing the individual they're caring for and asking the questions and not being accepting of necessarily that, you know, I was just talking about when people say they're fine. They say they're fine, they're you know, fine is not fine, all that kind of stuff, the different campaigns. But it's kind of making sure that you're enough in the relationship that there's a rapport. You're reading the room, you're reading the body language to understand when do I need to ask the next question to move forward. But I think the barrier you're talking about is real, unfortunately, for a lot of different reasons.
There are some initiatives to try to create some of like, kind of like a PHQ-2, you know, just a really brief two-question, you know, screening item that could be implemented. But then also alongside that, make sure that there's then an easy tool for physicians to use. Okay, if it does flag, if those two items flag, then what? Well, then what are you doing? And what comes next? And how do you refer and things like that? The other thing is right now there are some screening tools that are validated for adults. We don't really have a validated screening tool for pediatrics. And so
interesting.
That we at Equip are working on right now is we're in the testing phase of a pediatric screener with the hopes that we can develop something that can be deployed in pediatricians' offices. One of the issues with a lot of the eating disorder screeners right now is that they tend to focus on anorexia, bulimia, binge eating disorder, the eating disorders that are probably the ones that come to mind first, and also have a flavor about them that relates to negative body image, feeling of fat, feeling of fatness, fear of weight gain, things like that. There's another eating disorder that's very common in kids called ARFID, which stands for Avoidant Restrictive Food Intake Disorder. It's food restriction that is not driven by a desire to lose weight or a fear of gaining weight. It is food restriction that usually comes from some other source of often fear or discomfort. But in some cases, it's, you know, there was an episode of choking and now they don't want to eat food because they're fearful of, you know, choking again.
Gotcha.
There might be some texture sensitivity or something like that that is causing this food restriction. So ARFID is a lot more common in kids doesn't get picked up on the existing screening tools that we have for our other eating disorders. And so one of the things we're trying to do with our pediatric screener is to try to incorporate some questions that would also allow us to detect ARFID as well. But to your point, make sure that alongside whatever screener that is offered, that there's then a, okay, now what?
Absolutely right. And when you talk about things like social determinants of health, health equity, and so forth, I can ask the questions, but am I equipped to get them where they need to go and get them the resource they need to get to overcome those things? So that's absolutely right. And you, knowing that you guys are out there, can equip primary care doctors and others to be able to get the referral to the care they need. What are the one more question about this, and I could go on forever as a clinician because you're educating me, which I appreciate very much, and I think it's a topic that in my career didn't receive the attention that it was probably due and was somewhat mysterious and on the border of medicine and what I dealt with. And I've seen a lot of people's lives negatively impacted because they couldn't get the treatment that they needed to get. And so it's a real area of interest for me and touches a real nerve for me. What are the relapse rates for some of these eating disorders? Meaning that treat an eating disorder in an adolescent, how likely is it that they'll have a relapse rate or some long-term negative impact to their health for an extended eating disorder that they had while they were young?
Yeah, some of our best data on relapse actually is in, I'll call them the two eating disorders that most people think of when they think of eating disorders. They're not actually the most common eating disorders, but they're the ones that people think of: anorexia and bulimia. And rates of relapse are upwards of 30 to 50 after treatment, after existing treatments, I should say. What we're trying to do at Equip is improve that by, again, integrating recovery and treatment into their day-to-day lives. One of the hypotheses that folks have had over the years is when treatment is developed in such a way that you are stopping your life to do treatment, then now you stop treatment to do life. Well, you're not really fully equipped for how to translate everything you were doing in treatment into your day-to-day life.
Yeah, I loved it.
Sets you up for a high risk of relapse, right? So one of the things we're trying to do with our virtual treatment is make sure that you are doing the recovery-focused things in your day-to-day life. And in, you know, okay, so we have our session, you're in your home, we have our session, you are, you know, you just ate lunch, you're about to eat lunch, you're maybe eating lunch during the session, you're doing the things in your home environment where you are going to then live out the rest of your days. And so we want you to have your recovery focused work done there, with the hopes that is going to improve those relapse rates.
Yeah. And forgive my ignorance with this question, but it seems to me too that it really touched me when you're talking about the family involvement in therapy, because I think about, again, other complex disorders that involve environmental components. You can't take somebody who is an alcoholic and put them right back into a situation where the only thing the family recognizes for celebration is drinking and expect them to not have some increased risk of relapse, those kind of things. And I think when you think about attitudes toward food and so forth, there are communal attitudes toward foods and familial attitudes toward food, and the way we present food, the way we talk about food, all that kind of thing. So that really intrigued me. And then the other piece is the longitudinal nature of the recovery, because to me, given the complexity of an eating disorder, it feels like it's something that needs recurrent, regular maintenance in recovery, as opposed to, hey, you had an abscess on your arm, we drained it, it healed, you had an antibiotic, and it's gone, and you're fine, type thing. That there is some ongoing maintenance.
Yeah, there's a comment that our co-founder Christina has said before, which is like, you know, because of my history of anorexia, I can't just go on a quick diet for, you know, like I can't do that. I will take that and run with it, you know? Mm-hmm. And so to protect myself from relapsing into anorexia, I don't dabble in, you know, food fads, and I don't dabble in, you know, any of those things, because like that might be the hot new thing that's going on in society and culture, is like, oh, you know, keto or, you know, whatever the thing of the week is, right? I don't know, maybe keto is even outdated. It changes so fast, but whatever the food fad is, right? You know, she's like, I can't do those things because that will pull my brain just back into that mindset.
That is interesting. And I can understand that. I can really understand it. It's funny too, with all the food fads, that there is a small nugget of truth in a baseline physiologic concept for all these food fads, and they get blown out of proportion to something that was never intended to be, and way out beyond what the physiologic, you know, they take that physiologic principle completely out of context and create an entire lifestyle out of it. And people get fooled by it.
I mean, just the fact that it shifts every few years. Just so that it's not a real, you know, it's not a super solid.
It's interesting to me. The Blue Zones project is a project where, you know, global research for 20 years to come up with five things that really are associated with longevity. And it's interesting. Your grandma was right. And she didn't have 20 years of funded global research to prove it. Go out and play, get regular activity. Go to church on something, believe in something higher than yourself. Make sure you eat your vegetables, eat a well-balanced diet, you know, everything in moderation.
Absolutely. My grandma lived to be 102 years old, and she never did any of these kind of things. You know, she never did any fad. Absolutely. And, you know, your earlier point about your environment and your family and the people you're around, you know, So we use family-based treatment for our younger patients who are living at home and have, yep. you know, family to support them. But we can't do that with adults. We treat patients of all ages at Equip. And so we are adult patients who are living alone or, you know, living with their family, that, you know, their spouse and their children. They're not going to do family-based treatment. That's not a fit for their, life setup. And we also know the power of a social support system. And so while we wouldn't do family-based treatment specifically, because that is oriented toward like caregivers kind of taking charge of meal support and meal monitoring, that's not going to fit. But having your spouse, having your roommate, having your best friend understand what you're going through, understand how to support you, understand what some of the triggers might be to make things harder for you, is so important to being able to create that environment that is going to allow for recovery. And so while we might be doing a more individually focused treatment approach with an adult, we absolutely want to encourage them to bring whoever they have in their life, whoever they can have, who can support them and be a trusted, you know, source of, you know, just someone who gets it.
Yeah.
Is so valuable and powerful.
Yeah, because they're having to make decisions and choices that are foreign to them, probably, and difficult for them in an environment that probably doesn't recognize that they're difficult. So having somebody support that is incredibly important. Well, I'm going to, in the next couple of minutes, I just want to... The minor part of this conversation in my mind is, I know we've talked about connectivity and the importance of what we call interoperability. And I, as a clinician, don't really like that word. I've come to have to use it in the tech space, but I've never had a doctor ask me to be interoperable. They've all said, hey, can I get the CT scan from the urgent care? Can I get the lab that was done at the hospital? Can I get the note from the specialist in a timely manner? Can I just get my referrals digitally so I have their medications and allergies from a home care agency, that kind of thing? Tell me where kind of interoperability or the need to communicate and connect fits in with you guys, and what led you guys to CNO2 as a potential solution.
Yeah, I mean, you know, first and foremost, our biggest need that we have been working with you all on so far is that referral process. And so really being able to, we know it from our end, we have our own electronic medical record, and being able to do things within the electronic medical record. You're working in a patient's chart, you're already there, you're already in there, to be able to just go, boom, here it is, and send it through there and not have to go to another platform, open up another window, open up another, you know, go somewhere else. It's just so simple and so smooth. And so, you know, ensuring that people with other electronic medical records or other EHRs or health systems, that they can then send that referral to us, is going to make their life so much easier, which is also then in the end going to get patients the care they need faster.
Yeah.
And so, and again, when we go back to the screening idea, like if you are asking the right questions, which we hope you will, you know, in care of asking questions about binge eating or purging or food restriction, if you ask those questions and then you're like, oh my gosh, I don't know what to do. If you could just refer through the patient chart in your own electronic medical record, it's going to be a lot easier for you to then respond to that screening tool and refer for treatment.
Yeah, absolutely. But there are a ton of other eating disorders across the spectrum that you guys are also treating. But we'll take a quick break. We'll come right back. Kara, appreciate it.
Equip is the leading virtual eating disorder treatment for all ages and empowers families to help their loved ones recover at home by making evidence-based care accessible and affordable for all. With a dedicated 5-person care team, including experts in medication management, nutrition, therapy, and cultural humility, each patient and family receives personalized support tailored to their unique needs. And the results speak volumes. After just 8 weeks, 8 out of 10 patients report a significant reduction in eating disorder symptoms. Learn more at www.equip.health.
Connect. Listen. Transform. This is Notify with your hosts, Dr. Peter Schuck and Teresa Bell.
Well, Welcome back, everybody. We've had a broad-ranging discussion today, and Kara, I really appreciate you coming on. I've learned a lot today, and I hope our audience has too. It's been very beneficial for me. I want to give you an opportunity here as we wrap up. Is there anything that you want to emphasize from our conversation today or hit on, or maybe we didn't say it quite right and you want to correct it or whatever? I want to give you the opportunity to do that.
Yeah, no, I think we covered a lot. Really enjoyed this conversation. But I, you know, I think if I were just going to double click on anything, it would really be just the understanding that eating disorders are a broad range of illnesses. It's not just anorexia nervosa. There's a number of different ways that eating can become disordered and really harmful. And that all of the eating disorders are really serious. I think a lot of people think, oh, anorexia is the one, that's the one that really people die from. The others are, you know, bad, but it's less serious. And that's really absolutely not true. And it's also incredibly dangerous for people, regardless of what they look like. There's not a specific body size. It's not just, you know, emaciated bodies that are the ones who end up in the hospital at risk of severe medical complications. Bodies of all sizes, when they're suffering from an eating disorder, can really be harmed. And so treatment is so important and so vital to prevent that ongoing medical harm.
No, I really appreciate that and the call out there too. I think if there's a question and you're thinking about it, referring can't hurt. The worst it can do is tell them the good news that maybe you don't qualify as an eating disorder and your doctor was overzealous. But in the opposite case, then it gets them plugged in right away, not to the right treatment. The only things I would emphasize again are, I think, the differentiation in my mind of what you guys are doing with moving the treatment for eating disorders across the spectrum further upstream, catching it early when there's a greater opportunity to prevent longer term embedded patterns of behavior that are harder to treat and more likely to relapse. Really like that. I love the idea that you're scaling the specialization of knowledge in individuals with that knowledge and systems of care by doing it virtually. I love the fact that the virtual care is breaking down some of the health equity barriers and socioeconomic barriers that may have been present in in-person care. Not that in-person care is never needed in those regards, but the vast majority probably can be treated virtually and appropriately referred when necessary for inpatient or behavioral in-person stuff. And then I think the other piece that is important for me as well is just knowing you're out there as a resource to primary care doctors like myself who intend and want to do a good job, but don't necessarily know where to go get help. And so getting your name out there is important to me because I know your resources and because of your geographic reach allows doctors all across the country to be able to use you guys. So, and you guys will be taking digital referrals here now that you're connected through No2's API. So really exciting in that regard. And I just love the business approach of, hey, if we're going to reach the lives we need to reach, we need to be as frictionless as possible to do business with. And we're going to start with the referral process, both helping us and helping those who refer to us. So anyway, those were my kind of takeaway points as I think through the conversation that were just really important to me. So happy to have you here. And I really appreciate you taking the time to be on with us. Glad to have you as a No2 partner and really appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us today. That's a wrap for this episode. Please subscribe or follow on your favorite podcast platform to make sure you don't miss an episode. Get No2 connected today and set yourself and your organization free to unlock your potential. For more information on the value of being No2 connected, visit us at www.no2.com. Follow us on LinkedIn or Twitter. Connect. Listen. Transform.